Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009.
Sometimes. Charismatic, yes, sometimes. And not infrequently irresistible, because it's part of human nature for us ordinary people to want to warm our hands at the fire of a great creator. But those fires are very hot indeed, and I've known any number of people who got badly burned as a result of keeping company with greatness. Louis Armstrong was different. He was a great man who was also a good man, kind and generous and considerate. And unlike many good men, he wasn't even slightly boring. He was utterly unpretentious. He didn't talk in pompous clichés. He loved to laugh and knew how to make other people laugh. And on top of all that, he was the greatest jazz musician who ever lived. Armstrong was one of the cultural giants of the 20th century. America has never produced a more significant artist. I rank him right alongside Aaron Copland and Robert Frost and Frank Lloyd Wright. But unlike those men, he was also a great entertainer whose music was and is loved by ordinary people all over the world. In 1964, he actually knocked the Beatles off the top of the pop charts with his recording of Hello, Dolly. Aaron Copland never did that. You can see why I was drawn to the idea of writing the biography of so singular a creature as Satchmo, or Pops, as his friends called him. Needless to say, I am not the first person to have done so, but I am the first biographer to have had access to 650 reel-to-reel tapes that Armstrong made during the last quarter century of his life, many of which contain astonishingly candid recordings of his private after-hours conversations. Armstrong switched on his tape recorder whenever the spirit moved him. You can hear him chatting with friends over dinner, getting high with an old pal in his dressing room after a show, even trying to coax his wife into bed at 5 a.m. for a little hanky-panky. Not only do these tapes shine a bright light on his personality, which was far more complex than most people realize, but they also make it possible for us to know the full stories of such key moments in his life as his marijuana arrest. That's a big part of what made me want to write Pops. Nowadays, most folks know me as a drama critic, but as you heard, I am also a trained musician. The first one, in fact, ever to write a fully sourced Armstrong biography. I started out as a professional jazz musician, a bass player, before becoming a full-time writer. That experience has helped me, I think, to understand Armstrong's music and the world in which he lived and worked from the inside out. In Pops, I've tried to translate that knowledge into plain English and weave it into the incredible story of Armstrong's life. As Duke Ellington said, he was born poor, died rich, and never hurt anyone on the way. But how did he work that miracle? In the course of writing Pops, I came to feel that Armstrong's triumph was as much a function of his personality as of his musical genius. If you don't understand the one, you won't understand the other. And it is Armstrong's personality to which I want to introduce you now. So let's start in the best possible way, by watching him at work. What you are about to see is an excerpt from the earliest surviving film of Armstrong on stage. It was shot in Copenhagen in 1933. He is singing and playing Dinah with a band of musicians from Europe. Would you play the video, please?
The next time we're going to play players is one of the world favorites. That's that. Dinah. They got it, huh? Anyway.
That's the Louis Armstrong who took the world by storm in the 20s and 30s, the public Armstrong. In Pops, I take you backstage to meet the private Armstrong, for there is more to Louis Armstrong, much more than most people know. Though he was known the world over for his million-volt smile, Armstrong was a tough-minded, realistic man who always knew the score, whether it was about race relations or the music business or anything else. He loved to tell tales about his life, and he told them very, very well, for he was not just a gifted musician, but a gifted writer. Tallulah Bankhead, one of his biggest fans, said that he uses words like he strings notes together, artistically and vividly. Armstrong strung his words together very neatly indeed when he told the story of his encounter with a gun-toting Chicago gangster in 1931. He was working at a mobbed-up nightclub called the Showboat when what he described as a big badass hood named Frankie Foster came backstage after the show and told him that he'd be playing in New York City the next night. Armstrong said he already had a gig in Chicago. Foster pulled his pistol and cocked it. Here is how Armstrong himself described what happened next. He said, "Jesus, it sound like a cannon. It look like a cannon and sound like death. So I look down at that steel and say, well, maybe I do open in New York tomorrow." I tried to get that side of Armstrong into Pops as well, because it's as much a part of him as his genius. Joe Glazer, his manager, once said that Armstrong was a real, real man. He reminds me of something that my namesake, the Roman playwright Terence, wrote 2,000 years ago. "I am a man, and nothing is alien to me." Louis Armstrong was a real man, and nothing was alien to him, and he turned it all, good and bad, into music. Now, I'm going to read you part of the prologue to Pops, in which I try to convey something of Armstrong's personality in words. So now, an excerpt from Pops, A Life of Louis Armstrong. It goes without saying, or should, that Louis Armstrong's music was the most important thing about him. Yet, his personal story, in addition to shedding light on the wellsprings of his art, is important in its own right, and no less in need of a historically aware interpretation. He was a child of his time, not ours, and some of the things he did and said as an adult are barely intelligible to those who know little of the world of his youth. Even in his own time, he was widely misunderstood, often by people who should have known better. To understand him now, we must see him as he was, a black man born at the turn of the century in New Orleans, who by the end of his life was known and loved in every corner of the earth. What manner of man succeeded in making so amazing a journey? How did he rise above the unforgiving circumstances of his birth to become a culture-shaping giant? And what marks did those circumstances leave on him? Everyone who knew Armstrong agreed that he was what he seemed to be. "What you saw was what you got," said Joe Maraney, who played clarinet in his band, the All-Stars. Jack Bradley, a photographer whom Armstrong befriended in the 60s, described him as down-to-earth, natural, completely unpretentious, simple in the best sense of the word. It was his genuineness as much as his genius to which his fans responded. He once reacted to a radio interviewer's pronouncement that he was a living American legend by dropping his pants and giggling. "I don't care what company I'm in, what environment, you know," he said on another occasion. "I just want to be there and enjoy it, just as good as the average cat." Whether on stage or off, he was the embodiment of Johnny Mercer's admonition in Accentuate the Positive: "You've got to spread joy up to the maximum, keep gloom down to the minimum." Danny Barker, the New Orleans guitarist, saw him in his dressing room after a show and remembered the sight ever after. He wrote, "He'd be sitting down in his underwear with a towel around his lap, one around his shoulders, and that white handkerchief on his head, and he'd put that grease around his lips, look like a minstrel man, you know, and laughing, you know, natural, the way he is. And in the room, you see maybe two nuns. You see a streetwalker dressed all up in flaming clothes. You see maybe a guy come out of a penitentiary. You see maybe a blind man sitting there. You see a rabbi. You see a priest. See. Liable to see maybe two policemen or detectives. See. You see a judge. All of them different levels of society in the dressing room, and he's talking to all of them. And there'd be some kids there, white and colored. All the diverse people of different social levels, and everybody's looking. Got their eyes dead on him, just like they was looking at a diamond." He was, of course, the least average of cats, though his place in the history of jazz is harder to explain than is commonly understood. Armstrong did not invent jazz, nor was he his first significant figure, and it is not even right to call him the first great jazz soloist, as many critics and scholars have done. Sidney Bechet, the New Orleans clarinetist who was 4 years his senior, preceded him by a decade, while Bix Beiderbecke started winning national recognition at the same time as Armstrong, almost to the month. What then made Louis Armstrong stand out? And why is his name still known to those who know nothing else about jazz? The simplest explanation, and up to a point, the best one, is that he was the first great influence in jazz. No sooner did he burst upon the scene than other musicians, trumpeters, saxophonists, singers, started imitating him. "I tried to walk like him, talk like him, eat like him, sleep like him," said Rex Stewart, who replaced Armstrong in Fletcher Henderson's band. Coleman Hawkins, Henderson's star saxophonist, heard him for the first time in 1924 and was stunned into speechlessness. He remembered, "I stood silent, feeling almost bashful, asking myself if I would ever be able to attain a small part of Louis Armstrong's greatness." The trumpeter Max Kaminski told of how the combination of Louis's dazzling virtuosity and sensational brilliance of tone so overwhelmed me that I felt as if I had stared into the sun's eye. Such imagery came easily to those who heard Armstrong in his halcyon days. The poet Philip Larkin, a part-time jazz critic and lifelong fan, praised him in similar terms, calling him something inexhaustible and unchanging, like the sun. Even Miles Davis, who loathed Armstrong's mugging, knew that the history of jazz radiated outward from the bell of his horn. He said, "You can't play nothing on trumpet that doesn't come from him. I can't even remember a time when he sounded bad playing the trumpet. Never." What spoke to these artists, as it speaks to all those hearing Armstrong for the first time, is the combination of hurtling momentum and expansive lyricism that propelled his playing and singing alike. The four staccato quarter notes that he raps out at the start of West End Blues, his most celebrated recording, proclaimed the coming of a new way of thinking about rhythm. Though the passage looks innocuous on paper, it catapulted his fellow jazzmen into a musical world in which even the simplest of phrases were charged with an irresistible forward thrust. To be sure, his internal metronome was exact enough to impress the most fanatically rhythmatical of classical musicians. Herbert von Karajan once told the members of the Vienna Philharmonic that he was going to an All-Stars concert. "Imagine," he said, 2 hours of music, and never once will it slow down or speed up by mistake." But Armstrong could also toy with time, stretching it this way and that, as he does in the serene trumpet solo that ends his 1933 recording of Harold Arlen's "I Got a Right to Sing the Blues," hovering miles above the clockwork tyranny of the beat and sounding, for all the world, like a lordly turn-of-the-century tenor. The comparison is apt, for Armstrong liked, listened to, and learned from opera. "I like that deep stuff also. It gasses me to no end," he told Orson Welles. Late in life, he remembered buying his first record player, a wind-up Victrola, as a teenager in New Orleans. He said, "Most of my records were the original Dixieland Jazz Band, but I had Caruso, too, and Henry Burr, Gallicherchi, Tetrazzini. They were all my favorites. Then there was the Irish tenor, John McCormick. Beautiful phrasing." But his style was also permeated with the rough beauty of the blues, and if it was his way to sing and play them with a smile, he knew as well as anyone that the world of which he sang could be a hurtful place. He said, "Like when I play maybe Back of Town Blues, I'm thinking about one of the old lowdown moments, when maybe your woman didn't treat you right. That's a hell of a moment when a woman tell you, 'I got another mule in my stall.'" Even the classical melodies he loved took on a new tint when passed through the prism of his vast experience. "I seen everything from a child coming up," he said. "Nothing happened I ain't never seen before." He was forever reflecting on the things he had seen, sometimes on paper, but more often with his horn. "When I blow," he said, "I think of times and things from out of the past that gives me an image of the tune, like moving pictures passing in front of my eyes, a town, a chick somewhere back down the line, an old man with no name you seen once in a place you don't remember." That was why he never used musical terminology when speaking of his music. It was all about life. These are but a few of the myriad facets of Armstrong's art, and one can go a long way toward understanding him without mentioning anything else. But it is not enough to declare him a phenomenally gifted and imaginative artist and let it go at that. The other reason why he cast so long a shadow is that his personality was as compelling as his artistry. The two could scarcely be separated, for his lavish generosity of spirit was part and parcel of his prodigal way of making music. Even in his old age, he held nothing back, and it seemed at times that nothing was beyond him. He really did perform with everyone from Leonard Bernstein to Johnny Cash. He really did end his concerts, some of them anyway, by playing 250 or more high C's, capped with a high F. He wrote the finest of all jazz autobiographies, Satchmo, My Life in New Orleans, without a collaborator. The ranks of his admirers included Kingsley Amis, Jackson Pollock, Jean Renoir, and Le Corbusier. The composer Virgil Thompson called him a master of musical art. Stuart Davis, whose abstract paintings were full of jazz-inspired images, cited him as a model of greatness. Is it any wonder, then, that so many musicians longed to play the way he played and sing the way he sang? It was no accident that they usually referred to Armstrong not as Satchmo, his own favorite nickname, but as Pops. He was the father figure of jazz, and what his children wanted was to be him, or at least come as close as they possibly could. Why did Armstrong spend so many hours scribbling on a pad or hunched over a typewriter? partly because he was a gregarious man who enjoyed sending chatty letters to his friends and fans, but also because he believed that he had something of value to tell the world. Having been born desperately poor, he worked desperately hard, first as a boy and then as a man. In this, he had much in common with Ragged Dick, Horatio Alger's plucky bootblack, whose burning desire to grow up respectable propelled him into the ranks of the middle class. Self-discipline, self-improvement, self-reliance, these were his lifelong watchwords, and no Alger hero could have improved on his iron determination to get ahead in the world. Once he did so, he felt an obligation to tell others how to do the same. I was determined to play my horn against all odds, and I had to sacrifice a whole lot of pleasure to do so, he wrote in Satchmo. A few years later, he made the point more pungently in a TV interview. The Lord will help the poor, but not the poor lazy. While most jazz musicians, black and white alike, now come from relatively comfortable backgrounds, those who are born poor have almost always striven mightily to join the middle class. Anyone who doubts that Armstrong filled the latter bill need only visit his home, located 7 blocks from Shea Stadium in a run-down but respectable part of Queens. It is a 3-story brick-covered frame house whose interior is reminiscent of Graceland, Elvis Presley's gaudy Memphis mansion. From the Jetson-style kitchen of the future to the silver wallpaper and golden faucets of the master bedroom, the Armstrong house looks like what it is, the residence of a poor boy who cast down his bucket and pulled it up overflowing. Unlike Graceland, though, the house is neither oppressive nor embarrassing, and as you stand in the smallish study, whose decorations include a portrait of the artist painted by Tony Bennett, it is impossible not to be touched by the aspiration visible wherever you look. This, it is clear, was the home of a working man, bursting with a pride that came not from what he had, but what he did. I never want to be anything more than I am. What I don't have, I don't need, Armstrong wrote in his old age. My home is good, but you don't see me in no big estates and yachts. That ain't gonna play your horn for you. In common with other self-made men, Armstrong sometimes forgot that his success was due not solely to work and pluck, but also to the talent with which he had been born. He was a man of boundless generosity who preached the stony gospel of individual responsibility, a ferociously ambitious artist who preferred, when he could, to do as he was told, an introspective man who exploded with irrepressible vitality when he stepped into the spotlight, a joyous genius who confounded his critics by refusing to distinguish between making art and making fun. No more than any other genius was he all of a piece. As Murray Kempton said, he endures to mix in his own person all men, the pure and the cheap, clown and creator, god and buffoon. Yet all was resolved each time he raised his trumpet to his lips, for that was when the laughter stopped and the beauty began. He knew that showmanship does not mean you're not serious, and no one who has read his writings can doubt that he was both serious and self-aware. He knew who he was, what he had done, and how far he had come, and was fiercely proud of it all. He admitted that his music mattered more to him than anything else, even his wives. He said, "When I pick up that horn, that's all. The world's behind me, and I don't concentrate on nothing but it, that my living and my life. I love them notes. That's why I try to make them right. See?" The whole world saw and heard. So that's how my book starts. And now, if you don't mind, a few words of epilogue. I spent 5 years working on Pops, especially in the last few months. A great many people have asked me something like this. That's a lot of time to spend with anybody. Do you still like Armstrong? Do you still admire him? Or did you get sick and tired of him? Now, that's an easy question to answer. I didn't get sick or tired of Louis Armstrong. I don't see how you could. He is that rarity of rarities, a great man who improves with exposure. The better you get to know him, the more you like him. This isn't to say that he wasn't a complicated personality, because he was, very much so. Off stage, he could be moody and profane. He had a habit of flying into red rages that he forgot all about the next day, and he knew how to hold a grudge. "I got a simple rule about everybody," he told a journalist. "If you don't treat me right, shame on you." But that's merely to say that Armstrong was a human being, as flawed as the next man. And if there's anything that I learned in the process of writing Pops, it is that Louis Armstrong's flaws were few and forgivable. In return for his unswerving dedication to his art, he knew true happiness and shared it unstintingly with his fellow men. Not long before he died, he told a friend that, "My whole life has been happiness. Through all of the misfortunes, etc., I did not plan anything. Life was there for me, and I accepted it. And life, whatever came out, has been beautiful to me, and I love everybody." And I can't top that. So I will let Pops have the last word. What you're about to see is a TV performance of one of his favorite songs, "On the Sunny Side of the Street," originally broadcast in 1958. It is my favorite film clip of Louis Armstrong, the one that says the most about who he was and what he did. Take it away, Satch. And now the floor is yours. I would be more than happy to answer any questions that you might have about Louis Armstrong or about my book. I can't see you, so if you raise your hand, someone with a microphone will come to you, and I'll answer your questions. Any takers?
Yeah, I have a question.
Wait till the person with the microphone gets to you.
Okay.
so that everybody can hear. And don't forget the fellow down here, okay?
I haven't read your book at all, and I assume you addressed this question, but did Armstrong have an FBI file?
Yes, and it's of no interest at all. To my surprise, when I read it, it is innocuous. I was curious about whether his manager had one, too, and apparently that hadn't occurred to anybody. I was the first person to file a Freedom of Information request for Joe Glazer's FBI file. Filed it, appealed it, he didn't have one. So I can't tell you any exciting tidbits about either man that come from J. Edgar Hoover. Sorry. Down front.
Yeah, I have just actually two questions, one of which is listening to him sing Sunny Side of the Street. Can you speak to his influence as a jazz vocalist? It's almost hard to listen to him and not think of the influence that he had on Billie Holiday, but I think that there are probably others. And also, because he did live into the age of bebop, just what he thought of that revolution in music.
Sure, two good questions. He influenced everybody as a jazz vocalist. He is, in fact, really the first jazz instrumentalist whose voice, singing and speaking, became known to large numbers of people through his recordings. And he sang before he played trumpet. This is something that he was asked about, and he said, I played just the way I sang. And that's really central to understanding the relationship between the two. But the singing is a more immediate expression of the personality. And as I said in the talk, as I discuss in the book, this is really central to his acceptance in the mass as a popular entertainer. And that is as much a contribution to the history of jazz as was his genius, because it is because of Louis Armstrong that jazz first really came to the attention of a mass audience in an enduring way, and that is very historically important. He had no use whatsoever for bebop, he claimed. He called it this modern malice. But when I looked at the contents of his record collection, which are on deposit at the Armstrong Archives in Queens College, I found recordings by Jerry Mulligan, by George Shearing, by Stan Kenton, of all people. And he claimed to like some Thelonious Monk, and he respected Dizzy Gillespie very much as a player. The problem Armstrong had with bebop, I think, was that he thought it was a musician's music, that it didn't have a proper regard for the sensibilities of the audience. Agree or not, that was his position, and we'll probably be debating that for a long time to come. Here?
Did he write music? Did he write songs? Or
yes.
Write them down?
Yeah, he wrote quite a few songs. None of them became great standards that we all sing to this day, but some of them are quite well known among jazz musicians. He wrote one lovely ballad called Someday You'll Be Sorry, words and music. But his main achievement is not as a composer in the sense that we understand that, but as an improviser. I think it was Whitney Balliot who said of Thelonious Monk that his solos were frozen composition and his compositions were thawed music. And that's true of all great jazz musicians. It's definitely true of Armstrong. What came out of the horn, spontaneous as it may have been, has all of the unity of a composition. And I think that's his real claim to our attention. But he was a pretty good songwriter, too. We got him all over the place. Want to do here and then here?
Hi, Terry.
This is my research assistant, Stephanie Stewart. So if there's anything wrong with the book, you talk to her, okay?
There's nothing wrong with your book. You've been in this relationship with this project, and I'm curious to hear about a time when you were angry with Armstrong or something you came across, and a time when you felt that, you know, that feeling of falling in love with him again.
I don't think I was ever angry with him. He surprised me a couple of times, more than once, listening to the tapes, when I heard him speak very sharply about musicians to whom I had assumed that he was close his whole life long, and it turned out he'd held a grudge against them. That surprised me. But I don't think there was ever a moment when I was angry with him. He was not a person who inspired that feeling, unless you got on his bad side, and I guess I didn't get on his bad side. listening to the tapes, well, I'll tell you a story about one of the tapes. I referred to it in the talk. The one where you can hear him, you know, trying to get his wife into bed at 5 in the morning in a hotel room, Lord knows where, Tierra del Fuego. And she wasn't having any of it. It was 5 in the morning. She didn't want to do any of that. And then she noticed the tape recorder is running. And she looks at him and says, "You turn that off. In fact, erase some of that stuff off." And he says right back to her, "I can't do that. This is for posterity." Okay, imagine me sitting in the Armstrong archives of Queens College with a set of headphones on, and I'm playing this, and I listen to him saying that, and I think to myself, I'm posterity. I am the person he had in mind 50 years ago. And that was a very lovable moment, one of many. I think we had down front here.
My mother grew up listening to, well, I grew up listening to my mother listen to Louis Armstrong.
So did I.
Okay, and she went to many of his concerts, and I have a great affection for his music. This is a trivial question, but she always referred to him as Louis Armstrong.
I'm glad you asked that. He said Louis, and we know that for all sorts of reasons, but you all know that because if you've heard Hello, Dolly, you can hear him singing, "This is Louis, Dolly." But that was not just a casual preference on his part. He pronounced his name Louis because he was not a Creole. He was not a New Orleans black of French descent, a light-skinned black. He was a dark-skinned black of African descent. And in New Orleans, at the turn of the century, there was intra-racial prejudice, and light-skinned Creoles of color looked down on dark-skinned blacks like Armstrong. And that was why he made a point his whole life long of pronouncing his name Louis. But he didn't care what you said. Two of his wives called him Louis, several of his musicians. His own favorite nickname was Satchmo. That's what he loved to be called. But as I say in the book, most of the musicians who knew him called him Pops. I call him Louis because, A, that's what he said, and B, because I always like it if somebody in the audience asks me that question. And I'm glad you did. Yes.
I was wondering, did he have any children?
Not that we know of. I say that frivolously. There is an episode described in my book when he thought he had acquired a child, not by the fourth Mrs. Armstrong, felt very proud about it, and didn't turn out to be the case. And for the whole story, which is very funny, you know what to do. Go buy a copy of Pops. There is a fellow in Australia who claims that he is the natural grandson of Louis Armstrong, but he has not, so far as I know, produced any proof of this. I have a feeling, and it is nothing more than a guess, which is why it's a source note in my book rather than in the main text, that the reason why Armstrong had no children, he would have liked to have had them, is because he smoked marijuana every day for his entire adult life, and it probably depressed his sperm count. But I'm perfectly serious about this. But there is no way of knowing that for sure. So as far as we know, no kids. Here? Why not? I see you too, and we'll... I can see you a little better than I thought I could.
You had mentioned that Miles didn't like his mugging. And how did Lewis feel about that?
About how Miles felt?
No.
About Miles's music?
How he felt, was that a put-on that he had to do, or that I don't want to say character, but was that an affectation he developed, or just part of his personality?
It was part of his personality. In the book, I describe him as a major key personality. He was also, please remember, a man born in New Orleans in 1901, raised in the vaudeville tradition at a time when attitudes toward that kind of comedy among blacks and whites alike were very different than they are now. He loved the vaudeville comedy and songs of Burt Williams. He had many of Williams' 78s. This is the crucible in which he developed this performance style. He lived into modern times, and after World War II, many jazz musicians, Dizzy Gillespie prominent among them, were uncomfortable with the idea of a jazz musician who didn't present himself as an artist. But for Armstrong, this simply wasn't an issue. And if we judge him by our standards, I think we'll go astray in understanding him. I don't think we're ever really going to enjoy the movies he made in the 30s and the 40s, because there he was presented as a caricature figure. But it is very important to know those movies, and also to know that they played a huge role in his becoming a mass popular entertainer. But it was not an affectation at all. That was the real man, and I think especially the real man that you saw up there doing on the sunny side of the street. That's an artist up there, even though he's an artist who also likes to make everybody smile. Shakespeare was the same kind of artist. Right behind you is a man with his hand up. I want to try to get every part of the room if possible.
Can you speak to any association you're aware of that he had with Duke Ellington?
They made an album together in 1961 where Ellington sits in on piano with the All-Stars and they play a program of his music. They promoted that album on the Ed Sullivan Show, and there is a wonderful film clip of them doing In a Mellotone together. That's another one of my favorite Armstrong clips. They obviously didn't see much of each other because they were both on the road all the time. Armstrong was on the road 300 nights a year. How they felt about each other privately, it's harder to know. My guess is that Ellington thought that Armstrong was a little rough and that Armstrong thought that Ellington was a little fancy. Down here, why not? And I see you in the back, too.
I have two questions. First of all, I'd like to know in the room who actually saw Louis performing.
I'd like to know that, too. Who of you saw Louis Armstrong perform in person? Raise your hand if you did. Lucky you.
And the other question is, my favorites are the 20s. In his recordings, and the All-Stars. Mm-hmm. Which can you recommend in the 30s and maybe early 40s, which are lasting testaments to, to his art?
Well, if in your infinite wisdom you purchase a copy of Pops, you will find an appendix that contains a list of 30 representative recordings by Armstrong from every phase of his career. They are all, by the way, downloadable from iTunes, so you don't have to break the bank buying 30 albums to get them all. One of the things I tried to do in this book was to give a sense of the totality of Armstrong's career. I shouldn't give the game away, but a little later we're going to hear one of the recordings from the 30s, and I won't say any more for the moment. Back row, I think. Raise them high, folks, so I can see you.
What do the tapes reveal about Armstrong's relationship with Jack Teagarden, particularly the refusal of the city of New Orleans to allow the integrated All-Stars group to play there? And also, tapes also reveal anything about Armstrong's feelings about going on the State Department tour in the late 50s at the same time of the school integration? Mm-hmm.
The tapes don't have anything interesting to say about Teagarden, but we don't need the tapes to know because Armstrong went on record about that. When New Orleans passed an ordinance that made it impossible for blacks and whites to play in a bandstand together, Armstrong said, flat out, he was not coming back to his hometown, period, until they changed that. And he didn't, not until the Civil Rights Act in 1965. I don't know that the tapes shed a lot of light on the State Department tours, but again, that's an area about which we have a lot of public information. And my book tells quite completely and in an entirely unexpurgated way the story of when Armstrong got in a hotel room with a Cub reporter from Grand Rapids and told off Dwight Eisenhower and John Foster Dulles. I can't use the language that he used on this podium, but it is in the book. 12-letter words, I'll just put it that way. Down front, why not?
One of my very earliest childhood memories is of the movie The Five Pennies. It's probably the first movie that I remember from childhood. Can you tell us anything about his relationship with Danny Kaye and how he felt about doing those kinds of movies?
He, as far as I know, didn't have anything to say specifically about Danny Kaye. That is one of the best remembered of his films. He loved his films, even the bad ones. I think he loved them all equally because he was in them. He really liked making high society. And there's a wonderful tape in which he's talking about working with Frank Sinatra and Bing Crosby and Grace Kelly. And he says, you know, they were acting just like it was real. Well, as I point out in the book, two of them, it was real because Grace Kelly and Bing Crosby had just concluded a rather torrid affair. I'm not sure that he knew about that. But he loved doing these films. He didn't always love the way he was treated. In one of the tapes that I talk about in the book, he discusses how he was treated on the soundstage of the film Glory Alley. Again, in extremely blunt language that I cannot repeat here, but he felt, I think with very good reason, that he was being treated in a racist fashion by some of the people on the soundstage. Wish I could shed light on Danny Kaye, but about that I have not discovered anything. All the way over here, if you don't mind hiking.
Hi. You've written about the differences between what you term to be highbrow art and lowbrow art. And I'd like to hear you speak about Mr. Armstrong's position within that spectrum.
I don't think I've ever put it in quite that way. I just think that art is art. I've written a lot about what I call the middle brow moment in American culture, this moment when high art is being presented to a mass audience through mass media like television. And I think that Louis Armstrong is actually a very important figure historically in that moment, because the exemplary figure of this historical episode is Ed Sullivan. The man who, on his show, would put on Louis Armstrong and Edward Villella and Van Cliburn and the Rolling Stones. In fact, Armstrong and Rolling Stones were on the same night on the Ed Sullivan Show. That was one of the interesting things I found out about. But Armstrong himself, the idea that there's highbrow art and lowbrow art and that there's some division between them that can't be bridged, that wouldn't have made any sense to him at all. And I'm not so sure it makes sense to me either. Music is music. It's either good or it's bad. It comes in all forms. And Armstrong, above all, is the exemplary figure who tells us that ultimately it is possible to be serious in any number of ways, expressively serious. There is nothing unserious about Louis Armstrong, even when he is being funny, maybe especially when he's being funny. I mentioned Shakespeare earlier. I always hasten to point out that Shakespeare was the man who put a clown into Hamlet. That makes me think of Louis Armstrong. That came up in a question once. I should have put it in the book, but I didn't think about it when I wrote the book. So you can scribble that into the back page if you want. You can see him better than I can. Go to there's a right at the front row, right in front of you. Yes.
Well, thank you for being here.
I'm delighted to be here.
I wonder if you were to put Louis Armstrong's, or I should say, Sans Frills films back to back, you know, all in one big picture, how long would it last?
Well, I'd get a big pair of shears and cut out his scenes, because most of his films are perfectly awful. They're second-tier Hollywood films, although he appeared with an extraordinarily wide variety of first-tier people. None of the films is really first class in its own right, but when he comes on, when he gets in front of the camera loved him. You, just as you couldn't take a bad picture of him, he was, I should digress here because I think it's important, he could have been an actor. There are a few films in which he has lines to deliver, dialogue scenes, and immediately when he does this, you realize that he has the natural acting talent that so many great pop singers have had, and I think specifically of Frank Sinatra. If Armstrong had been white, I think he could have had a parallel career as an actor in exactly the same way that Sinatra did. But those roles were not available to a black man in the 30s and 40s, and really even in the 50s. And so it didn't happen. There's his next to last movie, the one he made just before Hello, Dolly, is a film that Sammy Davis Jr. produced and starred in called A Man Called Adam, in which Armstrong actually plays a dramatic role. It's a small part, but when you watch that, and he's toward the end of his life when he makes this, you really see the lost opportunity and grieve for it, really. Not that there was anything inadequate about what he gave us, but it would have been nice if he'd had a chance to do a role like that. Here, maybe?
After spending 5 years with a character, does it change you, or do you say, oh, I'm glad to move on?
I am not glad to move on. I mean, I have to, or they don't give you the money, but, you know, I enjoyed every minute that I worked on this book. And I felt, especially listening to the tapes, that I had come as close to knowing him, I'm not old enough to have known him, as I could ever come. I also felt very close to knowing him when I spoke to people who had known him well. I spent, I think, 6 or 7 hours interviewing George Avakian, who produced the great album of Armstrongs of the 50s, Louis Armstrong plays W.C. Handy. And George, who is now 90 years old, knew Armstrong extremely well. And when I talked to him, I felt as though the veil of the past was parting, and I was coming close to maybe knowing him. When I talked to his good friend Jack Bradley, I felt this. I wish I had known him, and I hope he would have liked what I have done with his life. I know this much. I know from what he said that he wanted an honest book written about his life. Otherwise, he wouldn't have saved all those tapes. And so I have written a book that, insofar as Armstrong had warts, contains them, and really tries to tell the truth about him. But the truth, as I think I've made clear, the truth is flattering, entirely flattering. So I'm going to miss him when I move on to whatever is next, very much so. We're just about out of time, I think. Okay, how about right here?
Was he a guy's guy, or was he a man who loved women?
He was a man who loved women. You know, I mean, he wasn't the sort of person that you can fit into those pigeonholes.
Okay.
He had, the members of the All-Stars, except for the singers, were all men. I think most of his closest friends were men, but he had many, many female companions, 4 wives, the first one a prostitute, the second one a jazz pianist, the third one a chorus girl, and the fourth one a showgirl. And he had quite a few girlfriends as well. But from everything that people who have known him have told me, he was equally accessible on a friendly basis to men and women. Now, how about the lady who has her hand up for the last question?
Well, thank you for writing this book. You beat myself and John McCusker in New Orleans, and Tad, the late great Tad, who should have written this book, yeah. Who was writing this book until his untimely death.
So I had to stand in for him.
But I'm Mr. Ori's daughter, so I wanted to say that Louis would have probably, from what I've gleaned from Stephen Lasker's copy that you sent him, I really liked what I've read so far, and I hope to read the rest of it.
I'm honored. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
Until you read the book, you won't know just how much that meant to me.
Okay.
And now I've gotten the signal that it's just about time to sign some books, but before I do, let's wrap it up with a record. My favorite Louis Armstrong record. I mentioned it earlier in the evening, but it is always better to hear music than talk about it. And so, without further ado, I offer you Louis Armstrong's 1933 recording of Harold Arlen's I Got a Right to Sing the Blues, which tells his story better than anything, better even than Pop's.
What's the matter with you, boy? Don't you know I got a right to sing the blues? I got a right to sing the blues. I got a right to be low down. I got a right to hang around. Down the moon. A certain gal.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the law firm Arendt Fox. Media support provided by KPCC 89.3 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.